A new name for the United Fruit Company. In June 1929, Minor Cooper Keith, the banana pioneer, the uncrowned king of Central America, died in Costa Rica.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our host and executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our co-host and senior producer is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our intern is Harry Krinsky. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or check out our SoundCloud page by looking up Flashpoints. To contact Dennis, call 510-848-6767 extension 242 or by email at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
In the aftermath of massive wildfires that burned across much of Western Oregon last summer, an incredible slew of post-fire logging proposals threatened to clear-cut over 10,000 acres of fire-impacted federal lands along the iconic Mackenzie and North Umpqua rivers. Tune into a special International Women's Day edition of Locus Focus, Monday, March 8th at 10 a.m., when we talk about the need to protect burned forests, not destroy them, with Samantha Krupp, community organizer working at the intersection of forest defense, climate justice, and feminism. Again, that's Monday, March 8th at 10 a.m. on KBOO Community Radio on International Women's Day.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Katya Sengel, whose latest book is From Chernobyl with Love, Reporting from the Ruins of the Soviet Union. Katya Sengel is also the author of
Bluegrass Baseball, A Year in the Minor League Life, and Exiled from the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back.
This book has been in the works for a while, I take it, even before you were working on the Cambodian book, is that right?
Yeah, actually, I started this before the Cambodia book, but timing-wise, it was a lot of publishers saying, we like it, but don't really have a place for it right now. And then it just became more topical when first Russia came more into with the previous elections, and then now Ukraine, people became more interested in the region, I think.
Let me get the date straight. You were there from about in Latvia and later in the Ukraine from about 98 to 2002 or something?
To 2002 to 2003. I'm bad on exacts, but I think that, yeah, right in that area.
And you were there at 9/11 in the Ukraine.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the Ukraine now, because you've been reading up. Have you been back since you left?
No, that's what's interesting. I have not, and I know it's changed immensely since then.
some things don't change, which is how people live on some level and the level of corruption. When you look at what's gone down, what do you see in terms of what the Ukraine has been doing apart from this particular event?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's interesting because even when I was there, the energy sector's always been a hot topic. And there was corruption back then, and I think obviously still is, so you have a lot of that. It's interesting, though, because now we've also got the younger generation that did not grow up under communism. So you got some of these. When I was there, it was still the people in charge, and in my generation as well, not me, but the people my age, had experienced communism, not their whole lives, but they had that background. Now you've got this younger generation that didn't have that background. So it could be very different in years to come as the older generations kind of move on. And I'm seeing some interesting younger people doing projects that are trying to change things and get different influence in there. But yeah, you have years of a certain kind of system in Soviet corruption that it doesn't go away overnight. It takes a long time for people to change.
You went over there along with a lot of younger people, though many people came over a few years before. I have a friend, Jeff, who was in Prague trying to be a writer there and a reporter. Food was minimal and everybody played guitars and it was a really weird scene. Is that sort of what it was like a few years later in like 98 in Riga?
I think so. It was interesting because it was open, but it wasn't that known yet. So it was the adventuresome people who would go there. Latvia also was off the beaten track a bit. So you'd get people, sometimes some former Peace Corps volunteers who overstayed. That was one of our writers in Lithuania was one of those. And then my editor, Steve, I think he'd come kind of on adventure and then ended up staying on in Riga. I would say male than female in that part of the world and at that time. But then there were some women as well. Not as many as you see now flocking to certain areas, or like Prague became so popular years later. But at that time, it was still, like you said, there were things that was hard to get. You still had Soviet-style service in a lot of ways, items that were hard to get. Definitely peanut butter and Coke were some of those items that you couldn't get.
Advil.
Yes, 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 yes.
When you were there, what was the food like? I mean, was there much food at the beginning?
There was enough. Like, there weren't lines for food, at least in the capital and where I was. But I remember someone laughed if you brought up the idea of being a vegetarian or anything. There was definitely meat and potatoes and more meat and more carbohydrates and not a lot of vegetables. The restaurant I used to go with another writer was the Hare Krishnas had a restaurant, and that was where you could get some vegetables and some spices and something different. So we'd all go to the Hare Krishna restaurant and get different kinds of food.
Well, this was still, you know, less than a decade after the Soviet Union broke up. Did it still kind of feel like the Soviet Union in terms of going to a restaurant or stores, things like that?
Yes, especially stores. I remember the process. You would choose what you wanted and get in one line, and you would be given a ticket. Then you take that ticket to another line, and you would pay for it. Then you get another ticket and take that ticket to yet another line to get your item. So I joked it was a way to keep down consumerism because it just took too long. You'd have to go through multiple lines, or we'd call them point-and-shoot shops. Everything was behind a counter. You couldn't actually get up and pick things. You had to point, and they'd bring it out for you. And sometimes if you had language difficulties or if you couldn't read that far away, you had no idea what you were pointing at and what you were getting.
What currency did they use?
In Latvia? Oh, gosh, now I'm forgetting. In Ukraine, it was the hryvnia, although everyone just called them rubles, and dollars, large money. Like, I was paid in dollars at both places. So, and especially in Ukraine, the currency was so unstable. You would keep dollars, and daily you would exchange what you needed. Larger items, you'd pay in dollars, but for smaller items, you needed to buy something at the grocery or something like that, bread. You would go to their kiosks every corner. You could exchange money, and you just exchange it. There weren't ATMs at that point, so you just exchange it and pay in the local currency, but it changed so often.
I was in Laos, and it's basically the same. You use their money for small items, like getting food on the street, and then bigger items, everybody uses dollars.
Yeah, yeah, like my rent, I paid in dollars, and you were given your salary in dollars, and yeah.
Got you single. You talk about watching TV. I guess at that point it was just kind of like old black and whites or old colors or what?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember. I think it was black and white, and I remember it was really badly dubbed. So you'd get these American shows, and I could pick up the first couple words in English, and then it would go into Russian. I always hated the show ALF, but I'd watch it just to feel like a sense of home. Yeah, very badly dubbed. And I think my TV was black and white. Technology changed so much. Internet was just kind of beginning, and it was very spotty. You wouldn't get at all places. So it was a lot harder to communicate with people back home than it is now, where you go to a place and you can kind of send them a message all the time.
And electricity in Riga and Ukraine, was it like, say, California 2019 coming and going?
You always had a candle or flashlight just in case. In the capitals, I was lucky, and where I lived, usually it was pretty predictable. But you go outside Kiev back then, some villages would have electricity 1 hour a day, but it was often in the middle of the night. So you'd have to time it, so you'd have everything you needed done with electricity during that time. Capitals were better. Occasionally, come home and there was no electricity, and it was just, there wasn't warnings or anything like that. It's just like, okay, no electricity today. And water, same thing occasionally. Okay, no water today. But much more regular in the capital. I think Riga, there was like a week or so sometimes in summer, it would just shut off the water. Outside capitals, regular shutoffs. And you'd have, again, usually maybe an hour or two a day of water. And so people would just fill their bathtubs. You'd make sure you were home during that time, although they'd change the time on you. Fill your bathtub so you would have water for the rest of the day when there was no water.
That could get pretty old pretty fast.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was very difficult. Living outside of Kiev, I never lived outside. I'd visit those places. It was very difficult. Just living took up all your time and energy.
One of the salient points that came out of From Chernobyl with Love was, you know, we in the West get this idea, and it's sort of understandable because the Soviet Union was a pretty harsh place to live, even in the cities. The opening of democracy or corruption, whatever it might be, sort of made things a little bit easier. But you talk in the book about a lot of people who had really good jobs and professionals who were suddenly out of work.
Yeah, I think what we forget, especially right after the collapse, and at least for a decade or so afterwards, the whole system had been destroyed. And so when a system is destroyed, the people who end up getting power, the people who are already in power, so the ordinary people are the ones who suffer. The Soviet Union worked when it was together, but when you separated out, you had one country producing one part of a car, another country producing. So it was meant to work together, and it was meant to fail when it falls apart. So it was just a mess with regular shortages, electricity, water all over the different countries, and then displaced people who had been moved different places under Soviet times. But yeah, professionals, teachers especially, most people still had jobs. They just weren't paid. So there was this problem. Like Sveta, one of the women in the book, she had a teaching job, and she'd had it for years, but she hadn't been paid in years. So she can't do it. And she was one of those who was outside the city, so came to the city to get work. So I think the collapse of the whole system really hurt ordinary people. And then Ukraine, the currency got devalued so extreme that the older generation completely lost their pensions, and the younger generation lost their savings. Like someone like Sveta, she would joke, she's like, I should have bought another degree while they were on sale, because it was so much chaos right after the collapse that you could buy degrees, you could do all these things. But of course, if you weren't in the position to buy them, you couldn't. So
more corruption. Got you single. Another sense I got, particularly in the Ukraine, where you were there a bit longer, was that the corruption was so overwhelming, it almost felt like nothing worked without bribery.
Yeah, and I think that was very difficult for me to understand, because I didn't grow up in a system like that, but it was more just normal, and it wasn't considered bribery or even bad. You know, it was just how things work. I remember when I was seeing a doctor and they were treating me, and medical care is free, but it was pointed out to me that if I wanted good medical care, I needed to pay the doctor. And I just didn't know how to do that when it's not official payment, how you actually go about doing this. So luckily my Ukrainian boyfriend did this and he didn't make a big deal out of it. But for me, it was like, well, do you just slip the money in or do you say thank you and give the money? I mean, it was kind of complicated, but for them, it was just every day. And it's the idea is, well, doctors aren't paid very well. And so if she's going to take good care of you, we'll give her extra money. So it's a system that no one considers it corrupt or bad. It's just how it is, and it's just understood. But yeah, everything from doctors to you get stopped at a traffic stop, you know, when you hand over your license, you put a little money inside. And so it's just kind of acknowledged that's what you do, and that's how it works. And so it was hard for outsiders to get it, and for those from there, it's hard for them to understand. I remember my boyfriend, when he first came to the U.S., he didn't understand what a speeding ticket was. I was like, he said, well, can't I just take the officer's picture? Because he was a photographer. I said, no, you can't do that. And he said, well, how about, can I just give him some money? I said, no, you get a ticket. He said, what's a ticket? He just didn't understand that it didn't work.
Some of the particular stories that you worked on are in the book. Chernobyl is key. You visited there when you were in Latvia, and then again, you went back in the Ukraine, right?
In Latvia, I did a story about Latvians who had been sent to help clean up, but I didn't actually visit when I was in Latvia. I ended up going when I was in Ukraine 4 times, I think, separate trips for stories. But yeah, I did. The first time I started reporting about it was in Latvia, and I thought that was interesting for me, is how those outside the country were sent even to help clean up and were just recruited and had to go clean up, and how inadequately they were prepared for that, just with face masks that were just cloth and not even really knowing what they were doing, in the lack of care of the people.
The number of people died from cancer afterward, right?
Thyroid cancer was the biggest one, and especially among kids. So there was definitely increased rate in that. And right away, there were a number of deaths from people who were right there on the site. And then there are a lot of other health issues that you can't necessarily say this caused this, but a number of people who did go to help clean up, and that's a lot of the people I was talking to, had suffered different kinds of cancers and things, but you can't often directly correlated, so hard. Thyroid cancer was the one that was really clear, yes, this was because of Chernobyl.
What was the medical care like for them?
Well, that was interesting. So officially in Ukraine, they had special cards so they could get free medical care. But when I was there in 2000, I remember, I think they had the cards, but they weren't receiving that extra care. Maybe 10% of it was some very small segment that were actually getting that. So they were supposed to get this extra special care and things, but it wasn't happening. So on paper, they were taken care of, but in reality, it wasn't happening. And in the medical situation, as I myself experienced in hospitals there, was not up to the standards we have here. Just the equipment, they didn't have up-to-date equipment. I mean, there were well-trained doctors, but just the facilities and equipment were not up to what we would have had here at the time.
You're listening to an interview with Katya Sengel, whose book is titled From Chernobyl with Love, Reporting from the Ruins of the Soviet Union. And by that, we mean 1998 to around 2002-ish in Latvia and the Ukraine. I'm Rich Walensky on Bookwaves. When you heard news from overseas, was it pretty much unfiltered?
That's a good question. I think so. I was working at an English language newspaper there, so we'd get wire services and we'd get things in. So I don't think by that point there was definitely oversight. Our editor at the English language newspaper, he was commonly held at the airport whenever he came and went by authorities for tax reasons, or once they came to inspect us for electricity issues at our office. So there was definitely ways they kept an eye on us, but I don't think they were able to control what information we were getting. My phone at home was bugged, and I know they listened to my conversations when I talked to my mom and stuff, but they didn't stop connections or things. So I think we were able to get pretty much all the information we needed.
And that was in the Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah.
And Riga was a little different.
Yeah, Riga, I don't think, because we noticed the bugging was so bad on my phone in Ukraine, we could literally hear the person click on once the phone. Riga, I never heard that. And Riga, I didn't have there wasn't as much, I don't remember the government coming into the newspaper office and doing things about tax or electricity, you know, kind of these reasons for oversight. It was Ukraine that really had a lot more of that.
Well, having been to places that didn't change over that one decade, a city like Kiev, I would think, would have changed. Were there more signs of westernization in Kiev but at that point?
Yeah, there were definitely, I think, in Riga there was a McDonald's, and that was like where everyone went. And that's when our water was shut off. McDonald's usually still had water. It was walking distance from our office. So McDonald's was, and you always knew there was tradition of you pay for toilets, public toilets a lot of times. So McDonald's had the free toilets. So I do remember McDonald's in Riga was a big deal. And there were McDonald's in Kiev. There was starting to get, I remember the U.S. Embassy, I could get a Diet Coke. You couldn't get that on the streets at that point. But you were starting to see more U.S.-type things, more westernization. Besides McDonald's, I don't think there was a KFC or any of those yet, but that you were starting to, I think McDonald's is the first one. Then you know the rest follows.
What was mentioned casually partway through the book, most of the people you dealt with were either Americans or foreigners who were had some money but were kind of struggling to get along. And then you met a lot of people in Latvia and later Ukraine who were poor. But there's a reference toward the end of the book about, you know, how the oligarchs lived. What was that like? Were there like certain restaurants that suddenly looked like, you know, the Four Seasons or something like that?
There's a lot more of that now. But you would just see people dressed. You could tell by the way they were dressed, their attitudes, the women. They were usually men, and then the women who were with them. And it just looked like mafia type. I don't know how else to say it, but they were definitely had plenty of money, had dressed in the fancy kind of expensive designer clothes, cars, really nice cars. There were certain, I think, restaurants or places where they would be. I didn't know any of them personally, so I didn't. But on the outskirts, you could see there was money and there was wealth and there were people who were profiting. I mean, you'd hear about them. But I never saw, I don't think I came across many up close much. Just on the street, you would kind of see. Right. And there got to be in Kiev, when I was there, some fancier restaurants, some fancier places.
Were the expensive ones cheap in our terms? You know,
I would imagine they would have been, because my apartment was a nice apartment. Not super, super nice, but it was nice. And it was, and this was, of course, what, more than 15 years ago now, but it was, I think, $300 a month. And that was a nice, not super nice. So super nice, you could probably get a super nice apartment for $600 a month, you know. So I would imagine it would have been cheaper than what we were here.
So you went to Chernobyl. And you were obviously a little nervous because you didn't know what the Geiger counter would be clicking. What did it look like? Did it just look a little bit wild? I know there's a city there that was abandoned.
Yeah, so there were two. There was Pripyat and there's Chernobyl. And it's a ghost town. It's really eerie. You've got, you go in the streets, you know, you can't even find the street signs anymore because they've even fallen off or covered by trees. Houses, you'll have trees growing right in front of the front door, so you can't even get in. You've got vines coming in and out of windows. The roads themselves, no one's maintained them or anything. And there are no cars on the road. There are no street lights. There's nothing. And there was no service, no shops, nothing. So very quiet. And then you go, and I was doing a story the first time I went on older people who had moved back in. So you'd be going down and there's nothing, and all of a sudden you'd notice some laundry hanging out to dry, and it was just eerie. And you'd go, and I went in the house. My guide at the time, he used to live in Chernobyl, so we went in his old house, and the calendar still, April 1986, literally just right there on the wall. And then everything's still there, but from 1986. So his sister was a teenager, and she had posters of the heartthrobs at the time Russian heartthrobs at the time, 1986, so you've got the hair, you've got these different styles, and here you are more than 15 years later, and you've got those on the wall, and then everything still there, because mostly, well, everything of value is gone. It's been stolen, but most people, they were supposed to be coming back, so they didn't take a lot of stuff, and so it's just left as it was, except then you've got all the metal's been stripped, because it's been scavenged and resold. So it's a strange mixture, but then you'll have family pictures there. Anatoly, my guide, he was picking one up and it was of his parents and they'd passed and he wanted to take it. And he said, I don't have this picture. And I was like, well, why don't you? And he said, but the dust, he was worried contamination from the dust. So he didn't take it. So even though some of their stuff is still there, people often don't take it because it's contaminated.
So then an entire wardrobe of clothing that hadn't been stolen, let's say, would still be there and you can't really take it. And even the thieves probably shouldn't take it.
Exactly. Yeah, I worry about, you know, all the metal that was taken and probably ended up in Kiev and other places. Anything that was of value, but clothes, things like that, yeah, was left. And it should probably stay there.
I interviewed Martin Cruz Smith, who'd written a novel that takes place a few years later in Chernobyl. He said he went there and there were a lot more feral animals and the plants are very big and it's really eerie. It's not quite like a wilderness. Is that what you found?
Yeah, and the people I talked to, I remember they would talk about pigs, wild pigs, and because a lot of the ones who move back, and they're doing this illegally, they're not supposed to live there, and there were only a couple hundred of them or something, they would grow their own vegetables and things because they can't, there are no shops. And they would talk about wild pigs that kind of were scary and coming close. And then they also talked about, well, another problem was fires, actually. There'd been a fire on their house, but there's no fire department because there's no one's supposed to be living there. So they had to try and put it out themselves, but there's no water service either. So it's just a disaster. All these things you don't think about, but when you're living in a place that's abandoned, you can't cope with these things. But I didn't see any wild animals myself, but I had heard stories about them. Another trip later, we went to just outside the exclusion zone, and there was this huge, huge cat. And of course, everyone was joking about how the cat was, the photographers were getting a kick out of taking pictures of this. I think it was just a really fat cat, but of course you get all these things. And then they started doing some experiments with cows to see about milk contamination and stuff. So they were doing some scientific inquiries when I was there on some of that.
Katya Sengel, so you were in the Ukraine and you were going to go to Moldova. And on the way, what happened?
The Soviet Union did these interesting things. They move people who are from a region out and move in Russians and do all this. But Transnistria was a sliver between Ukraine and Moldova. Well, it's officially part of Moldova. This is the rumor that a lot of Russian military weapons were left behind. No one's really been able to find those weapons. And so what happened, though, basically it declared itself its own country, Transnistria, had its own president, has its own money, which I will tell you, if you try and exchange that money once you get out of the country, everyone's just going to laugh at you. But in the country, if you don't have the Transnistria money, you can't buy anything. And tiny, tiny area. And so I decided, well, I want to go to a country that exists to no one except themselves, and Russia acknowledges them. And of course, being there, also a lot of room for corruption and lots of news stories and things. So I wanted to go there. And so it was really complicated, though, because the first time we took a bus and the first time we stop at a border, I didn't know if it was Moldovan authorities or Transnistria authorities, who aren't official authorities. And so what to do? And they give you, once you get to Transnistria, you have to like check in with the police, and then you have to make sure you check out and things. But then when you get to Moldova, you think you've already checked in because you've already officially in Moldova, because Transnistria is part of Moldova, but yet it doesn't consider itself. It's very complicated when you get to the logistics. So I kept getting pulled on and off this bus, and I wasn't sure which authorities I was working with and if they were actually real authorities or not.
What's the situation now?
You know, that's a good question. I know the guy who was president when I was there is no longer president. I think it's still a breakaway republic, and I think it's one of those that never got resolved. He had his own book. He gave me his book about his country and him, and it was like the biggest ego. Just the strangest thing, when I had an interview with him, it was on their national TV, and I'm sure that was part of his celebrity thing. Oh, the American journalist came here to visit me and things.
Yeah, a national thing, which isn't a national.
It was funny, though. We were on the buses there, and Sveta, the translator from Ukraine who I worked with, was like, they're heated. I remember when things were heated. And there's still the hammer and sickle still there, so it was still very Soviet style. And she was reminiscing a lot of bad memories, but heated buses. She was just thankful that there were heated buses again, because at least some things worked under Soviet times, whereas they didn't anymore in Ukraine in a lot of ways. So I always found that funny. But we had someone following us the whole time, pretty obviously. Oh, there he is. Should we go ask him for directions? Because we're lost.
Got you single. Well, now you've been back for 15, 18 years, and you think back. What lessons, Katya Sengel, have you learned yourself that you can apply in some way, having gone through that experience as a young reporter in these countries?
The trust of regular people, the people I would interact with mostly were just regular people, and how similar, despite cultures or different things, regular people are. You know, leadership changes in different countries. I think also for that region of the country, I love, there's this humor, survivor humor that I love, that I think taught me a lot. Trusting people and not necessarily trusting government or institutions to take care of you, but just trusting other people. And I think that stayed with me as a lesson, that I definitely trust those relationships and value those. Also, things can fall apart. You have to protect yourself, because who knows what's going to happen.
Katya Sengel, this book is out and you've been working on it for a long time. Have you started working on another one?
I have. I'm actually working on juvenile mental health and institutionalization. And I'm not sure where I'm going with that yet, but that's the one I started working on.
You've been listening to an interview with Katya Sengel, whose book is titled From Chernobyl with Love, Reporting from the Ruins of the Soviet Union. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
An extended version of this interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of the kpfa.org website. Bookwaves.